From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Since the 1970s, writer Edmund White has chronicled gay culture in his works of fiction and nonfiction. He lived in Paris for 16 years, where civil unions between gay couples are now legal. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with White about gay culture today and the movement to ban gay marriage. White has a new collection of essays called Arts and Letters. Also, British filmmaker Mike Leigh talks about the moral dilemmas he explores in his new film Vera Drake. Set in 1950, it's about a working-class woman who secretly performs abortions. Leigh's other films include Secrets and Lies and Topsy Turvy. And classical music critic Lori Schwartz reviews the new DVD, Mary Martin and Ethel Merman, their Ford 50th anniversary show appearance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. President Bush today nominated White House legal counsel Alberto Gonzalez as the next attorney general, replacing John Ashcroft. Gonzalez said today that all U.S. citizens deserve justice.
As a former judge, I know well that some government positions require a special level of trust and integrity. The American people expect and deserve a Department of Justice guided by the rule of law. And there should be no question regarding the department's commitment to justice for every American.
Gonzalez must be confirmed by the Senate. Gonzalez helped shape the Bush administration's controversial legal strategy on interrogating enemy combatants, which says that torture isn't always forbidden in those interrogations. With Yasser Arafat apparently on his deathbed, President Bush says he considers the possibility of a new Palestinian leadership as an opening for Mideast peace, NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
President Bush blames Yasser Arafat in large part for the breakdown in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. In June of 2002, he urged the Palestinians to replace Arafat with a leader who, as he put it, is not compromised by terror. As Palestinians made preparations for Arafat's funeral, White House reporters asked the president about what lies ahead. Mr. Bush responded that there will be an opening for peace when the leadership of the Palestinians asks for help in building a democratic and free society.
When that happens, and I believe it's going to happen, because I believe all people desire to live in freedom, the United States of America will be more than willing to help build the institutions necessary for a free society to emerge so that the Palestinians can have their own state.
The president said he looks forward to being involved in that process. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
As expected, the Federal Reserve has moved to raise short-term interest rates by another quarter point, while reserving the right to increase rates one more time this year, if necessary. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The stock market had largely already priced in the latest quarter of a point rise in interest rates to 2%, so reaction on Wall Street was fairly muted. And in the statement issued at the conclusion of its meeting, Fed policymakers said with inflation still well contained, that means any future moves on interest rates can be carried out at a measured pace. With the latest rate hike, the Fed has now boosted rates four times this year. The Fed meets once more in December. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
The federal government is lowering the terror alert status for financial institutions in New York, New Jersey, and Washington from orange to yellow. Yellow signifies an elevated risk of attack. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down nearly 1 point at 10,385 in active trading. This is NPR News. A 15-hour standoff in the Netherlands ended today when police arrested two terrorist suspects, and a third was detained in another city. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Amsterdam.
The standoff began when special forces tried to storm a house in the capital, The Hague, but the effort was aborted when the suspects threw a hand grenade, which exploded, injuring three officers. By this evening, the standoff ended when special Dutch forces stormed the building, arresting two people, while a third was detained in Utrecht. Authorities said the raid was part of a continuing terrorism investigation, and it came only hours after the funeral of controversial filmmaker Theo van Gogh, murdered a week ago in reprisal for his strong criticism of Islam and Muslims. Six suspects, including a 26-year-old Muslim youth of dual Dutch and Moroccan nationality, are being held on several charges, including terrorism. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Amsterdam.
Hundreds of French citizens are fleeing from the former French colony of Ivory Coast. Commercial jets have been requisitioned to fly thousands of foreigners out of the West African nation. The evacuations come after days of anti-French riots and looting. Sudan's government ended talks with rebels today on the country's Darfur region without a long-term resolution of the violence there. African Union mediators say talks will start again next month in Nigeria. Delegates at those talks are expected to work on a political agreement. Sudan did sign peace agreements with rebels yesterday. The deals are aimed at ending hostilities in the Darfur region. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edmund White, has been chronicling gay culture since the 1970s. He's the author of 17 books, including the autobiographical novels A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony. The series begins with a character growing up gay and confused, trying to become straight. The trilogy concludes with the death of a lover from AIDS. White won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his biography of the writer Jean Genet. White now directs the creative writing program at Princeton University. His new book, Arts and Letters, is a collection of essays about writers and artists, including Oscar Wilde, Allen Ginsberg, James Baldwin, Vladimir Nabokov, Marcel Duchamp, and Andy Warhol. The book opens with a personal essay called Writing Gay. In 1983, White moved to Paris, where he stayed for the next 16 years. He now lives in New York City. I asked him about his reaction to the movement to ban gay marriage.
Well, I mean, I guess since I lived in France for so many years, where the law went through rather easily for civil unions, I can't help but be struck by the difference. And I think the main difference is that America is so religious. I mean, France is theoretically Catholic, but the people, I think, could best be described as Catholic atheists. But I think that what the French discovered is that when they originally proposed the pacts, which was their word for the civil unions, as a strictly gay thing, it got rejected. But then they rethought it and they said, all right, we'll propose this as a union between any two people who've lived together for at least 3 years and who share their lives. And it can be mothers and daughters or brother and sister or straight couple or a gay couple. And that went through perfectly. So I think it was very well calibrated to the French national character, which is one that honors the abstract individual and believes in universalism. Whereas I think in America, the real problem, I mean, what's interesting is that the statistics in America show that a large percentage of Americans accept the idea of equal rights and things like visitation rights in hospitals, being able to maybe get tax benefits that a couple might enjoy. But what they really reject is the idea of a church wedding. It's the sacred aspect, which, I mean, and in a way they have a point. It does run counter to a lot of the Bible, which is really hostile to homosexuality.
Would you be supportive of legislation in America similar to what was passed in France that would open the idea of civil unions to any two people who have lived together a certain requisite amount of time?
Yeah, I think it's a very intelligent approach to the problem because I think it picks up, I mean, the problem with any legislation that gays are campaigning for is that there's so few gays. I mean, I think my own feeling is that probably only about 3% of the population would really declare itself to be lesbian or gay. I mean, many more people have had homosexual experiences, but they don't define themselves as gay. But so I think it's important to pick up other allies, and I think there are an awful lot of young couples who are living together, straight or gay, who and older couples. I mean, all kinds of people, or as in France, mothers and daughters. I mean, people who are basically sharing their lives and who want to share all the legal benefits of any normal couple.
Are you surprised that so many gay and lesbian couples want to get married? I mean, when you came out in the 70s, there was really a debate over whether, you know, marriage was something gay people even wanted. Was gay life going to be such a total reexamination of the nature of relationships and social rules and everything that marriage wouldn't even be in the picture even if you could have it?
Well, I think a lot changed since the 70s. I think that most of the visible and vocal gay spokespeople in the 70s were leftists. And they were the only ones who were really willing to come out and who felt that gay life was part of the great spectrum of progressive leftist causes. Then I think what happened is in the 80s, AIDS brought out of the closet, forced out of the closet, many people on the right, many established, well-to-do people. And you get the phenomenon of the log cabin Republican, that is, these gay Republicans. And since they were establishment people, they sort of took over. And the whole movement got taken over and dragged to the right and toward the goal of assimilation. I mean, my generation, I'm 64, and my generation of gays in the 60s and 70s was definitely felt very revolutionary. And I think gay liberation began under the aegis of similar movements like women's liberation and black liberation, but and the Vietnam War protests. That was all that era, and gay liberation began in 69 at the height of that those protest movements. But as I say, in the 80s with the advent of AIDS, I think the whole thing shifted to the right, and a kind of special destiny for gays was dropped in favor of an idea of assimilation.
Well, maybe being gay is just less radical than you used to think. Do you know what
well,
I mean? Like maybe there's a complete political spectrum of gay people, just as there is with straight people, and it's not necessarily a kind of, you know, counterculture or alternative culture type of thing.
Exactly. Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that even a lot of the counterculture people in general, straight or gay, feel are floundering now. They don't quite know what to do with themselves or what their constituency or program might be.
You know, you write in your new book that you think the ardor and zeal that gay people are bringing to marriage may actually renew the prestige of the institution of marriage, even in the eyes of straight people. I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
I mean, I do think that people who belong to minority groups oftentimes crave the legitimizing of the establishment. I mean, I wrote a little biography of Marcel Proust, for instance, and everybody wondered at the time of his life why he was so eager to get the Legion of Honor from the French government. It seemed like here he was this genius. What need could he possibly have of some tacky award that every neighborhood butcher can get in France? And but he absolutely wanted it. And I think it's perfectly clear. He was somebody who was half Jewish, entirely gay, and really felt excluded from French society, though he was revered by literary people. And I think he wanted that legitimizing thing. And I think it's very similar to many lesbians and gays, that they really crave having the society at large say, yes, you're okay, you're like everyone else, and yes, you can adopt, and yes, you can have normal families. And I think we need that more than straight people do.
Did you ever want to get married?
I never did. I was engaged to two different women when I was younger and struggling to go straight. And again, I think that was this kind of almost magical idea that people have about marriage, that it will transform you, that you will become somebody else. And I think the tragedy of marriage is that you don't become somebody else, that you stay the same old person with the same old problems. And maybe even with the new fears that, oh, my God, I'm going to be in this for the rest of my life once you're married. But in terms of gay life, no, I never. It always seemed to me that what was attractive about gay life for me was that it expressed a lot of freedom from basic cultural institutions, that it was the sort of the rebel's way. And I always liked the kind of wild boy run with the pack, stay up all night, be close to almost a juvenile delinquent. That aspect of gay life, that sort of adolescent boy aspect of gay life, always appealed to me immensely.
Because you've chronicled gay culture for several decades now, I'm curious to see where you think gay culture is now, both in terms of the impact it's having on popular culture and in terms of the degree of homophobia it faces now?
Well, I think that there's a curious bifurcation, even in the minds of fairly conservative people, that if they know gays, they tend to like them as individuals or not like them, but anyway, to treat them exactly as they would anybody else, and they see them as human beings. And I think part of the humanizing effect has been has come from the fact that many gay people have come out, so they're identified and identifiable. And it has come from shows like Will and Grace and Queer Eye for Straight Guy and all these programs, which I think have, whatever we might think of their politics, nevertheless, they've made gay men and to some degree lesbians seem like part of everyday life. And so all that has sort of warmed people up at the same time that various Christian religions, and Muslim for that matter, and Jewish too, have preached against homosexuality. So it seems to me that there's this sort of strange schizophrenia in America. And I do think that it's a very depressing moment for gays. And I think that my main feeling, and it sounds childish to say it, is I feel hurt. I feel hurt that my country, or at least so many of my fellow countrymen and women, have rejected me. I feel it on a very personal level, and I think many, many gay people do. I had dinner with a group of gay guys last night, and we all sort of felt like taking our toys and leaving the playground and going away someplace else. I mean, people talk about moving to Canada or going to France or doing different things. And I think there's this real feeling that for years and years and years, there was a slow but steady progress that was being made in terms of acceptance and visibility. But now I think we see that even though gays are very visible, more so than they've ever been, it hasn't really led to acceptance, not in a generic or legal way.
My guest is writer Edmund White. Since the 1970s, he's chronicled gay life in his works of fiction and nonfiction. His new book is a collection of essays about artists and writers called Arts and Letters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ed White, and he is the author of many books chronicling gay life, gay culture. He's written fiction, memoir, biography, and his new book is a collection of essays called Arts and Letters. He directs the creative writing program at Princeton University. You lived in Paris for, was it about 16 years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you moved back to the States 4 years ago. You say in one of your essays in your new book that when you came back to the United States 4 years ago, you were surprised by several things. Those things include the institutionalization of identity politics, the rise of political correctness, and the growth of Oprah-style programs and the memoir industry. Let's start with the institutionalization of identity politics. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that in the 60s and 70s, there still were broad coalitions of people on the left, and people weren't really campaigning full-time about a single issue. I mean, I think one of the maybe tremendous, well, I don't know really what I think about this, but let me just propose this for a second. Maybe gays should have insisted that the gay marriage idea be withdrawn now, in the interest of a large coalition on the left. I mean, in other words, if we can't have a Democratic president, then we're all in trouble. And in fact, that's what happened. And if the gay marriage issue was, as people are claiming, actually one of the main reasons why Bush won, then maybe it would have been much better tactics to withdraw the gay marriage issue altogether at this time. But would a group of gay activists be able to do that? Would they be able to put their own interests aside for a moment in the interest of a large leftist or progressive or coalition? And I don't think so. And then again, there's another part of me that says, well, wait a minute, would you dare say to blacks, okay, well, let's put aside your longings for equality in the job world or in the courts. Please put that aside for the next 4 or 8 years while we sort other things out. We wouldn't dare ask them to do that, and we would certainly feel that there was something strange if they were willing to do that. So I don't really know why gays should sacrifice their interests in the interest of a larger cause. So you can see I'm debating this back and forth in my own mind. Mm-hmm, I don't quite know what I think about it. But it did seem to me that it was very bad tactics at this to have brought up gay marriage as a leading salient issue at this time.
Another thing that surprised you when we returned to America from France was the growth of the Oprah-style programs and the memoir industry.
Well, I think they go together, and I think that memoirs, when I was young, were written by the general who won the Battle of Iwo Jima, or General Eisenhower, somebody who was already established as an important person, and then at the end of her life sometimes, he or she would write a memoir that would sort of trace out the facts of this already inherently interesting life. But in my day, nobodies never wrote memoirs. Nobody wanted to read the memoir of a nobody. But then, by the time I came, and so when I, for instance, wrote about my early life in a novel called A Boy's Own Story, I was very careful to call it a novel and to bring to it all of the traditional means for involving the reader and instilling some interest in my life in the reader that would be used by a novelist. I mean, it was clearly a novel with all the novel's traditional strategies. But then by the time I came back at the end of the 90s, all that had been replaced by memoirs, and people would now write memoirs about a disability or about a dreadful childhood they had had or about belonging to a minority group or something like that. So in other words, it was all sort of part of the culture of complaint, I suppose, that and the Oprah-style program where people also got on and talked about their abuse as children and so on, that was all new. And what's interesting is that, I mean, just to give you a tiny example from my own life, when I published Boys on Story in 1983, though it contained a lot of very personal information about my own life, people who interviewed me would never have dreamed of asking me a personal question. They were always very careful to say, the protagonist in your novel, the first person narrator in your novel goes through such, and then I would say, yes, he does. And there would never be a moment where I'd say, yes, I did, or I do that. So it was all kept in a kind of distant, impersonal level of discourse. Now, of course, everybody skips that. And even if you claim that your book is a novel, people are quick to ignore that and just go for the jugular and ask the most personal questions imaginable.
You've written several autobiographical novels that many people, I think, even confuse with memoir because they're fiction, but they shadow your life in some way, even though the character isn't you. You're now writing a for-real memoir. You have an introductory essay in your new book, Arts and Letters, about writing gay. And you talk about how, I think it's in this essay, you talk about how when you started to write, writing was almost like therapy for you. You had to write. You had to get out the anger that you felt and the feelings of alienation. And so it was part therapy and part just that you were a writer. Why, at this point in your life, have you decided to write a memoir and to not mix your life, you know, to refashion your life into fiction?
Right. Well, I guess having written that trilogy, Boys on Story, Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony, I feel like that is a sort of self-contained unit, that I thought, well, it'd be interesting to cover all kinds of things that I never even mentioned in those books and to present them in an entirely different way formally. So, first of all, it is the truth as best as I can establish it, whereas I took many liberties with the truth and especially with chronology in the fictional trilogy. Because in those novels, I was always trying to design a good novel. So I would, if there had been five lovers, I'd reduce it to two. If there had been, if I'd been in a place for 7 years, I might make it 1 year. In other words, I was always trying to condense and simplify the actual facts of my life to make them more coherent artistically. Whereas in this book, which is called My Lives, I decided to cut the pie in a very different way and to organize it not chronologically, but thematically. So there's a chapter called My Shrinks, for instance, in which I just talk about the five shrinks that I saw over a 25-year period. And it's, I hope, quite a funny essay. And there are other ones where I we'll talk about my hustlers, for instance, because even when I was 16 years old, I began to hire hustlers. I was always fascinated by hustlers. And so I give a whole long look at that. When I first started doing it, I was so young that people were that the hustlers were often I was older than me and very shocked that anybody so young would want to hire them. And then later, of course, I became more the ordinary age for hiring hustlers. And it's always been a very minor part of my life, but a constant part. And it's something I found interesting to write about. I still leave an awful lot out. Like, I don't talk about my teaching. I don't really talk about my friendships, although friendship has probably been the main theme of my life. But I somehow worried about writing about my friends because I felt like either people would feel I was saying too much about them or I was dropping their names in ways that they didn't like or I wasn't including them and they'd be hurt. But I thought, this is such a mess. I'm just going to stay out of it. And also my friends are really more valuable to me than my books are. So I thought, to hell with it. I'm just going to preserve that as my own private domain.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's great to talk to you again.
Edmund White directs the Creative Writing Program at Princeton University. His new book is a collection of essays about writers and artists called Arts and Letters. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease on the web at alz.org, and from Harcourt, publishers of Michelle Faber's The Courage Consort, three novellas by the author of The Crimson Petal and The White. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British film director Mike Leigh talks about the moral dilemmas in his new film, Vera Drake. It's about a working-class woman who secretly performs abortions in 1950. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new DVD, Mary Martin and Ethel Merman, their Ford 50th anniversary show appearance. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The British director Mike Leigh is best known in the States for his films Secrets and Lies and Topsy Turvy, which was about Gilbert and Sullivan. His new film, Vera Drake, is set in England in 1950 when the country is still recovering from the war. Vera Drake lives with her husband and two grown children in a small flat. Her husband is an auto mechanic. She cleans houses for a living. But she secretly performs abortions. Not for money. She never takes any. She sees her job as helping women who have no other option. But Vera Drake is not medically trained, and her technique is primitive and unsanitary. After a woman nearly dies from an infection, the police find out about Drake. She's shattered by the news of the woman's infection and by the impact her no longer secret work will have on her family. In this scene, she's getting questioned by a detective inspector. Vera Drake is played by Imelda Staunton.
Can you answer my question, please? How do you help them out?
When they can't manage.
When they can't manage?
That's right.
You mean when they're pregnant? So, how do you help them out?
I help them start their bleeding again.
You help them to get rid of the baby. You perform an abortion. Is that right, Mrs. Drake? You perform abortions, don't you?
That's not what I do, dear. That's what you call it, but they need help. Who else they're going to turn to? They got no one. I help them out.
Just to set the scene for us, can you tell us what the law about abortion is in England now and what it was in 1950 when your movie's set?
Well, the law was changed in England and Wales in 1967. Before that, abortion, as in many places in the world then and now, was outlawed. There were exceptional circumstances in which abortions could take place, and that is dealt with in a subplot in the film, in Vera Drake. When the film is set in 1950, it was simply, on the whole, a matter that was dealt with by illegal, illicit backstreet abortionists, and that's what the film is concerned with.
Now, there are a lot of back-alley abortionists who are opportunists, who preyed on women with no options, but that's not Vera Drake, your main character. She's the kind of woman who helps her neighbors. She takes care of her family. She always has a tea kettle on. She's a very she comforts other people, and she performs abortions because she empathizes with the women who she feels, for whatever reason, can't have this child. She feels they have no one to turn to, and she can help them by providing an abortion, a word that she won't even use. She says, "I help young girls out." Would you describe how she performs the abortion?
Well, I mean, she simply injects an alien fluid into the uterus, and that causes a miscarriage. But I think the point about her approach to it and the kind of woman that she is and represents is that in all societies, at all times, there have always been Vera Drakes, women who, you know, whether they're in your family or in the next street or the next block or the next village or the next town, who were there who knew how to deal with this problem. And she's one of those, basically. And she doesn't do it for money. She does it, as you say, because she thinks that it's important to help people.
Now, you said she injects a substance into the uterus, inducing an abortion, but it's kind of horrifying when you see what she's doing because, you know, she's not a medical professional, and she uses a very kind of primitive, unsanitary means of providing these abortions. And because she doesn't make follow-up visits, she is not aware of the infections that sometimes set in.
I think she's aware of the risk. And in fact, she knows that she's using a disinfectant. And she actually doesn't know whether she has previously caused infections, as ultimately happens during the story of the film. But the important thing is, I mean, the general implication of the whole thing is that indeed if, for example, in the States, the law were to be changed, as is being discussed, the legislation, and if you were to go back to a situation where abortion was outlawed, then amateurs would be back on the scene doing what Vera Drake does. And it's for listeners to decide whether they think that is acceptable or not, really.
Throughout the movie, there's no speeches. Nobody makes a speech about whether abortion is right or wrong, no matter what the context is, no matter what the scene is. And I was greatly relieved by that, not so much because of the issue of abortion, but because I just hate those kinds of speeches in movies where, you know, where suddenly somebody who isn't very articulate or talkative is eloquent, and they make the speech, and the audience is basically supposed to, like, rise and cheer on their behalf. You managed to get through this whole movie without any of that.
Well, I mean, I make films, and this is by no means the first such film that I've made, which are very much character-driven. I mean, my job is to create absolutely believable three-dimensional characters, and that's what I hope has happened in this film. And what I also am committed to do is to make films that confront the audience with questions rather than lay on the line simplistic black-and-white polemic. And so here I'm disposed to raise questions and confront the audience with the moral dilemma that this whole issue is about. And so, you know, here is a very good woman who is undoubtedly motivated by very positive desires to help other people, but who we have to look at in the role of a criminal because of the laws of society. And it's up to the audience, really, to make those speeches, if you like, which you very properly say the film don't happen within the film. There is a point in the film where there is a bit of argument about the whole issue when the son is horrified by what's happened, having discovered what his mother has been doing over the years. And there's just a moment when she does actually come out and make a very quiet, simple statement about why she does it. But you're absolutely right. There's no scope for these characters who would otherwise be inarticulate to stand up and convert themselves, metamorphose themselves into Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird.
The film is dedicated in loving memory of your parents, a doctor and midwife. So your mother was a midwife and your father was a doctor?
Yes, my mother had been a midwife long ago and really stopped doing it before I was born. But my father was a doctor and was an ordinary general practitioner in a working class practice in Manchester. And indeed, until I was 13, we lived over the shop, so to speak. I would love to have talked to him last year when we were making Vera Drake about his related experiences, just, you know, as an ordinary doctor with a working class practice, just dealing with, you know, women that wanted to terminate their pregnancies or indeed abortions that had gone wrong and related things. I couldn't because he died in 1985, and so I put that little memory to them on the end of the film.
Now, you are well known for your improvisational technique in making movies. And my understanding is you only tell the actors what they need to know for that part of the movie. So in other words, an actor in one of your films wouldn't know all the twists and turns of their fate. They would just know the opening scene or the opening few scenes. And then as the movie goes on, they find out what happens to them. Is that an accurate description?
No, it's not quite accurate. I mean, the principle of it's generally right. But in fact, what it really is that no actor in my films ever knows any more than his or her character would know. That's the point.
I see. Okay.
And that's and we rehearse for 6 months, as we did for this film, before we shoot anything. And during that time, we create the raw material, out of which, having done that, we then shoot the picture in a very formal and classical way. So what we shoot is very, very thoroughly rehearsed and precise. So the first take and the 13th take are exactly the same material. The surprise isn't in the first take on camera. It's some months previously during the rehearsals.
When you're casting actors, do you usually look for actors who you are confident will have improvisational gifts and will be able to add through improvisation to the character's development?
Absolutely. The sort of actors that I like to work with are actors who are intelligent and have a social sense and have a sense of humour and a sense of people and are character actors. And by that, I don't mean that in the Hollywood sense of once gorgeous people who are relegated to the rank of playing grotesque cameos. But by character actors, I mean people who are versatile and can play all sorts of different people and get inside their skins and can work together in a... Also, actors who can work together in an ensemble. And I look for those kind of actors, and we're blessed here with great actors in England, and those are the actors that I try and get in these films.
Now, unless you've already worked with an actor, how do you know if they have those gifts?
Well, you develop instincts and ways of auditioning and finding out, which I'm not going to tell you because they're a trade secret. I mean, I hadn't worked with Imelda Staunton before, actually, but I know her work and I know her a bit. I've known her over the years, and I've sensed that she would be very good indeed in this film, and it turns out I was right. She's wonderful.
Is there something specific within a scene that dialogue or a twist of the character's fate that she came up with that you could describe?
Well, the whole performance consists of a growth of the character. And indeed, there is, without spoiling it for people that haven't seen it, I mean, you know, when you see the film, there's a moment when, you know, they come to arrest her and you see her going through, you see her whole world collapsing in one continuous series of moments. I hold on her face, and you just see everything changing. And that's an amazing piece of acting, which comes completely out of the organic improvisation and investigation that we did in order to arrive at the material.
Since you brought it up, you know, she is arrested in the movie, and some of the reviews express their disappointment that this character emotionally collapses and kind of gives in to the authorities. She shows no spine after she's arrested, and I have to say I didn't see it that way at all, and it seems to me...
No, I mean, I think that's an eccentric and rather kind of ivory tower sort of view of things. I mean, that really comes from people who, for whom every movie has to be a kind of fake celebration of human dignity in a completely implausible and Hollywood kind of way. I mean, this film, Vera Drake, you know, looks at something that inevitably happens to somebody as a result of the way society is. And indeed, what's important is that the audience, when they share her journey with her, they feel what she feels and go where she goes without having to be let off the hook by simple fake devices.
My guest is British film director Mike Lee. His new movie is called Vera Drake. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British film director Mike Lee. His movies include Secrets and Lies and Topsy Turvy. His new film, Vera Drake, is set in 1950. It's about a working-class woman who secretly performs illegal abortions. The movie's set in 1950, and there's still a black market for goods in England, goods that remain scarce in the post-war years, like tea and sugar. You were born in 1943, so you came of age. I mean, you were growing up in this era. What are some of your memories of post-war England and some of the shortages, some of the difficulties that faced families?
Well, when I was a kid at school, at Christmas, there would always be a Christmas party at which Santa Claus would come. It was always a teacher dressed up in a white beard. But in order that Santa could give out sweeties, candy, to the kids, we had to bring in our sweetie coupons, that's to say the coupons that the Ministry of Food supplied in order that sweets could be bought, so that they could go and buy sweets, candy for Santa Claus to give out. I mean, that's one of my memories. That world was a world of utility, you know. There was a kind of drabness and it was a world in which, certainly up until the beginning of the 50s, not very many things were new. I mean, most of the things around in the house, in the street, even the things that grown-ups wore, dated back to before World War II. I mean, things hadn't been replaced. It was a very grey atmosphere, although it was a very warm atmosphere because people were putting their lives together after the trauma of the Second World War. And indeed, that spirit is something that I've tried to capture in Vera Drake.
How were your parents' lives affected by the war?
Well, my father qualified as a doctor in 1939, but he never got to be a regular doctor till 1942. 47 because the war intervened, and for most of the war, he was away. Some of the British army was, he was an army doctor, and he happened to be in southern Africa for most of the time because they had troops down there training Africans to go and fight in Europe, you know. And he was, you know, he spent a lot of time in army camps in Africa. And so my parents didn't see each other. And this, of course, was the fate of millions of people all around the world. And, of course, it's a very, it's, when you think about it, that's quite something. I mean, he managed to get back twice, to pay two visits, resulting in myself and my younger sister. I mean, you know, it's tough. And then they, after the war, they had to put their lives back together again.
How aware were you of that when you were growing up?
Oh, very. The expression before the war, during the war, and after the war was an expression that you heard grown-ups using all the time. Oh, you were totally. And also, I mean, Manchester, which is where I grew up, was very severely hit in the Blitz by the Germans. And so, you know, one grew up surrounded by collapsed buildings and you know, bomb sites. And so one was very aware of it.
So you grew up in Manchester, and in your early years you lived above your father's medical office. What was it like being the son of the family doctor in a working-class city?
Well, it meant that I was one of the few middle-class kids in a working-class school. There was no particular significance to it. I mean, the main thing about living over the practice, the surgery, as we would call it in England, was that, you know, there was it's a very heavy industrial area, and in those days, before the Clean Air legislation, there was very thick black smog on the air, you know, that was affected people's breathing. And so I would remember coming home from school and going through into the house via the waiting room, which would be full of mostly men, just you know, just a chorus of that going on. It was some sort of the music of my childhood.
Wow. what movies did you identify with growing up? Did you gravitate toward, you know, more kitchen sink kind of movies, realist movies?
Well, there weren't any when I was growing up until the very end of the 50s, mm-hmm. At which point that happened to be when I came to London and discovered world cinema. And that was the time of the British New Wave. But the British New Wave, for me, wasn't half as exciting as the Nouvelle Vague, the French New Wave. And as I say, I discovered world cinema then, because when I was a kid growing up, you could see all kinds of movies, but they were all American or British movies. And so there was an endless diet of, you know, Hollywood and British war movies and British comedies and westerns and all the rest of it.
Which were the ones that you loved and that made you think, boy, if I'm really lucky, I'll do this one day?
Well, I was a sucker, and indeed I still am, for all kinds of movies. I mean, I went to the pictures, as we called it, to the movies, as often as they would let you. And but the moment which crystallised for me the notion of being a filmmaker was actually when I was 12, when my paternal grandfather died. It was a very snowy day in December 1955, and there was thick snow on the ground, and we were all gathered together in the little house, and these old guys struggled down the stairs with drips at the end of their noses with the coffin. And I just remember looking around and thinking, wow, this would make a fantastic film. And then thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to make films.
Mike Leigh directed the new film Vera Drake. Coming up, critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new DVD of Mary Martin and Ethel Merman performing on a 1953 TV special. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In the early days of television, there was a variety special that was broadcast simultaneously on two networks. The year was 1953, and the show marked the 50th anniversary of the Ford Motor Company. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that one segment of that show, a medley sung by Broadway's two biggest stars, Mary Martin and Ethel Merman, remains unequaled for its sheer entertainment. That duet and other solo numbers from the show are now on DVD.
Hi, Ethel. Hi, Mary. How about singing some old songs?
I think that'd be fun.
Good. By the light of the silvery moon, I want a spoon to my honey I'll croon love to. Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, when the clouds go drifting by. We will be so happy, Nelly. Don't let me hear you make a sigh. Don't let me hear you make a sigh.
I'm old enough to remember watching the Ford 50th anniversary show on June 15, 1953. But I've never forgotten it, partly because I wore out my 10-inch LP of the classic medley of songs sung by Mary Martin and Ethel Merman. It was the first time these great stars appeared in public together, and they made a splendid team, although they were almost polar opposites. Merman's voice had the clarity and power of a gleaming trumpet, though she could also be deeply poignant, as in I Get a Kick Out of You, the Cole Porter song she introduced in Anything Goes back in 1934. Martin's voice was sweeter. She was a trained opera singer, but she could be delightfully brash, sly, and devilish, as in the Porter song written for her, My Heart Belongs to Daddy. We don't think of them as playing the same kinds of parts. It's as hard to imagine Mary Martin as Mama Rose in Gypsy as it is to think of Ethel Merman as Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music, or Peter Pan, both written for Martin. And yet, though Irving Berlin conceived of Annie Oakley in Annie Get Your Gun for Merman, Martin played Annie on the national tour and did it on television. One of the revelations in the TV medley was how beautifully their two very different voices and styles blended.
When I'm calling for you upon my knees, tea for two and two for three.
Will you answer
yes, me for you when you are alone? Nobody near us to see us, to hear us, to friends or relations, a weekend vacation. We won't have it known, dear, that we all are down.
The entire Ford anniversary show, including the medley, was ingeniously put together by choreographer Jerome Robbins. Naturally, at the center of the medley are songs Merman and Martin introduced, Irving Berlin's There's No Business Like Show Business and You're Just in Love, the Gershwins' I Got Rhythm, Porter's I Get a Kick Out of You, all written for Merman. And Rodgers and Hammerstein's I'm in Love with a Wonderful Guy and I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair. And Harry Van Tilzer's Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly, an old song Martin turned into a big hit. We can also hear two songs that were left off the LP, and they're marvelous. Martin's tenderness and Merman's eye-rolling exuberance in these are high points.
Bay, cuddle up and don't be blue. Smile, my honey dear, while I kiss away each tear. I want some love that's true. Yes, I do. Indeed, I do. You know I do. I give me, give me, give me, give me what I cry for. You know you've got the kind of kisses that I die for. You know you made me love you.
Sun goes down, tide goes out. Don't get the problem.
We don't have stars today that shine as brightly as Merman and Martin did for so many years. And one reason may be that there are so few songs anymore that transcend the shows they were written for. The Ethel Merman-Mary Martin duet represents more than a bright moment in television history. It's an emblem of a lost world of wit and glamour and style. Once upon a time, there really was no business like show business.
No business like no business I know.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Mary Martin and Ethel Merman, their legendary appearance on the Ford 50th anniversary show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by The Teaching Company, offering video and audio recordings of courses by college professors. Their catalog, The Great Courses, is available at 800-LEARN-98. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sickened, The True Story of a Lost Childhood, a memoir by Munchausen by proxy survivor Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the conservative movement that has reshaped American politics with journalists John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist. Their new book is called The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.